Good evening, and welcome to the Weekend News. I'm April Lewis, reporting for KMUD from our studios in Southern Humboldt. Before the news, I'd like to bring up KMUD's Spring Drive. Please support KMUD during our Spring Membership Drive, April 13th to the 22nd. Your donation helps us broaden our programming and keep you up to date with local news. Go to kmud.org and click the donate button during our fund drive, April 13th to the 22nd. You can also send a check or cash to our mailbox. It's P.O. Box 135 in Red Way. Zip code 95560. That's P.O. Box 135 in Red Way. We'd really appreciate any amount you can give. Every day, it costs $1,600 to run the station. That's $66 every hour, or about a dollar per minute. Our CPB funding isn't coming back anytime soon, as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has officially dissolved, and now our members account for one quarter of our funding. To keep our news broadcast going, we need your help. Again, you can go to kmud.org to donate. I'd like to emphasize that without this funding, without your donations, we will struggle to maintain emergency and breaking news coverage we have brought you in the past. That includes fire warnings. That includes coverage in North Mendocino and areas of Southern Humboldt with elevated fire risk, especially in this dry year. As news director, I would like nothing more than to bring you the most comprehensive, accurate, and up-to-date emergency coverage possible. But we need the staff and resources to make it happen. Please help us as we continue to provide this essential service. Please donate. The membership drive will be this month from the 13th to the 22nd. And we appreciate all of you who have given your money and time to help KMUD. And now to your weekend news. Starting today, we'll be implementing a format change where the Friday and Saturday newscasts are reserved for longer format, in-depth content, alongside your weekly sports coverage from Ray Hamill. We'll be skipping the rundown and going straight into our stories. That said, we'll always make time for breaking local news and emergency alerts. And now to in-depth reporting from our news team. First is Gabriel Zucker with a further update on the Republican meet and greet at Old Growth Cellars this past week, including information on additional candidates who attended.
The Humboldt County Republican Party held a candidate meet and greet at Old Growth Cellars in Eureka on Wednesday, April 8th. The event focused on Chad Bianco, the Riverside County Sheriff running for California Governor. Six other candidates attended the event, including two Humboldt locals. The two Humboldt local candidates were Audrey Hanks and David Collenberg. Audrey Hanks, the current deputy assessor, is running for the open Humboldt County assessor position. She explained the role of county assessor during the meet and greet.
The assessor's office is a nonpartisan office that works for all voters and property owners. If you rent, if you pay a mortgage, if you own a business, then property taxes affect you. The assessor's office is tasked with locating and valuing all taxable properties within the county and identifying ownership. In Humboldt County, there are around 76,000 parcels and almost 9,000 personal property assessments. The assessor's office also reviews and applies exemptions to qualifying properties, maintains assessor parcel maps, and represents the county at local appeal hearings. Currently, the assessor's office has a staff of 27 members. Over 67% of Humboldt County's property taxes goes towards funding schools in our county. The remaining portion is then divided by an allocation to the general fund, special districts, cities, roads, and libraries. So property taxes play an important role in this county.
Hanks grew up in Humboldt County and went to college in the Midwest, graduating from Oklahoma State University before moving back to her home, Humboldt County. She has been working for the county assessor's office since 2010. Hanks served in a variety of roles before taking on her current position.
I take the responsibility seriously to assess fairly, as outlined in the California Revenue and Taxation Code. In 2003, I began working for the assessor's office as a certified property tax appraiser. In 2010, I was promoted to the supervising appraiser. And I have been in, for the last 10 years, I have been in my current role as a deputy assessor, where I oversee the real property department. When the current assessor made the determination or the decision to retire, I decided that it was time for me to begin the next career, the next chapter of my career. With his endorsement and his encouragement, I am ready to take this next step. I have spent almost 23 years learning the ins and outs of the assessor's office. I have helped thousands of taxpayers over the years, and I am committed to this office and want to continue to help serve the people of Humboldt County.
She said she is committed to the office and wants to continue serving the people of Humboldt.
I am committed to serving the public in a professional manner, treating everyone fairly and within the law as outlined in the California Revenue and Taxation Code. Customer service is important to the assessor's office, and we understand the need for you to be able to speak with a live person when you come in or call into the office. If elected as your next assessor, I will be ready to work on day one. I have the required appraisal certificate from the California State Board of Equalization. I have almost 23 years of experience of learning the ins and outs of the office. I have the support and respect of the people within the office and numerous other offices that work closely with the assessor's office.
The other candidates running for this position is Ben Larson. Since he did not attend this event, KMUD will cover the opposing candidate on a later date. The other local candidate that spoke at the event was David Collenberg, running for lieutenant governor. He introduced himself, talking about his past experience in the Humboldt area. Collenberg reminisced about driving a tractor up and down the highway, his Tony's ice cream runs with his kids, and picking them up from school. After originally planning to run for California governor, he was told by friends about Chad Bianco and came to the realization that
this race wasn't about me and, you know, being governor. It was about me having a voice. And so I was like, well, next best spot is lieutenant governor. And if we have Chad Bianco and me, it's an unstoppable team to make this state great again. So that's what I did. And it's been very supportive. I just got endorsed by Solano County and some other candidates.
According to the official website of the California Lieutenant Governor, ltg.ca.gov, the duties of Lieutenant Governor are: the Lieutenant Governor of California plays a vital role in state leadership, serving as acting governor when the governor is out of state, and assuming the office if a vacancy occurs. As President of the Senate, the Lieutenant Governor casts tie-breaking votes and serves on key higher education boards, including the University of California, California State University, and California Community Colleges. Collenberg wants to be a voice for California's rural regions.
In California, you know, there's always talk about water for farmers in the Central Valley, but there's never talk about waters for the farmers in Humboldt County, Siskiyou County, Modoc County, none of it. You know, every time they talk about it, it's always about Central California.
Yeah.
You know, I'm from here. When I was a kid, would we have 250 dairies here? What do we have now? Maybe 30? Arcata has one. I grew up in Arcata. There was dairies on every corner. There's nothing now. There's one, Darren Ferreira, and thank God he's still keeping it alive. You know, our timber industry, we used to have like 35 mills. What do we have now? Maybe five. The fishing industry, we used to have 400 boats. We have maybe 80. How about the cannabis industry? It's gone. So every industry in Humboldt County is gone. Why? Because regulations, taxes, and government overreach. So we have the State Water Board with unelected officials. We have the California Air Resource Board with unelected officials. We have the Coastal Commission. Every board that they have is unelected officials that has done nothing but ruin everything in this state.
There is no public election for the California Coastal Commission. The 12 voting members are appointed by the governor, the Senate Rules Committee, and the Speaker of the Assembly. 6 members must be local elected officials from coastal districts, according to the California Coastal Commission official website. This is the second story KMUD has done about the recent Humboldt Republican meet and greet. The final story will run next week, and we'll be looking at statements and claims made by the candidates and what talking points lacked important context. This is Gabriel Zucker with KMUD.
Next, we have Daniel Mintz with a report on warning the Rio Del City Council on earthquake risk, followed by highlights on the issue of homeless encampments from the Eureka Council.
Dr. Wendy Bone of the California Geologic Survey's Seismic Hazards and Earthquake Engineering Division told the Rio Del City Council, quote, "I will try not to scare you," at the start of her April 7th presentation on seismic hazards. Rio del Mayor Deborah Garnes had alluded to the scary things Bowen has said in the past to a council presiding over a city that bore the brunt of impacts from a December 20th, 2022 earthquake and a follow-up one on January 1st, 2023. Bowen's presentation explained the causes and outcomes of earthquakes in what she described as the, quote, tectonic bumper car area, that is, the North Coast. Some faults are close to Rio Del, and quakes from onshore faults have more serious impacts. Bowen described the Rio Del fault lines that make it an especially active area.
So if we zoom in close, you can see Rio Del there. The closest orange fault to you is the Little Salmon Fault, and that's just to the north. That fault has had three earthquakes in the last 1,700 years. The largest earthquake that it can have, we think, is probably around a magnitude 7.1. So that's where that is. There's some other faults around. There's the Ferndale Fault that's close by, the Rust Fault Zone that's nearby. So all of these faults can potentially have earthquakes. If you're interested in earthquakes, this is a really good place to be, because of the 11 magnitude 7 plus earthquakes in California that have happened since 1900, five of them have been up here. So this is the place in California where you are most likely to feel earthquake shaking from a magnitude 7 earthquake.
Bowen summarized an earthquake history that includes magnitude 7 quakes in 1980 and 1992 and the 6.4 magnitude 2022 quake, which was preceded by a 6.2 quake on the same date a year earlier. Is there a significance to the precise one-year spacing? Bowen said there isn't. She said, quote, it is just that you keep having bigger earthquakes. She also explained that how you feel the intensity of an earthquake varies, saying, quote, what you feel depends on largely where the earthquake is and where you are. She said when people describe a rolling earthquake or a jolting one, quote, what that's telling us is how far away you were. Answering questions from council members, Bowen emphasized the significance of impacts from lower magnitude earthquakes occurring with semi-regular frequency.
I get a little frustrated with the media because they're always like, does this mean the big one's coming? I'm like, the big one is the one that happens near you, causes damage to your community.
Right.
And so it shouldn't be, you know, a contest that, well, we have the biggest earthquake, our earthquake was bigger than yours. If it does damage and if it was felt and it scared people, then it was a big deal.
Absolutely.
And so a 6.2, a 6.4 on land here is a huge deal. A 7.1 out in the ocean that you don't feel as strongly is a less important deal.
Council members related their earthquake experiences. Council member Frank Wilson talked about the late 2022 earthquake sequence, where the initial 6.4 quake was followed by a 5.4 magnitude quake on January 1st.
And then the one that we had in, 2022, and then we have the one we had one a week later. And the one a week later was centered real heavily around Rio Del. And it was the violence of the second one compared to the first one. The first one had a higher number, the second one had a lower number, but it was a very violent and I think all of this council was here for that. And what it did to our city, what it did to chimneys.
Yeah.
My own chimney and different things that took place. The magnitude thing doesn't mean anything to me.
Mayor Garnes said the northern part of Rio Del was, quote, hit super hard by the December 20th, 2022 quake, while the subsequent January 1st quake, quote, destroyed the southern end of town. Bowen said, quote, my guess is that it was closer to you, and that's why you felt it more strongly, even though it was a smaller magnitude earthquake. City Manager Kyle Knopp said the city is encouraging people to sign up for the state's Earthquake Brace and Bolt Seismic Retrofit Program that was launched in 2023. With regard to city infrastructure, Knopp said it's a matter of, quote, building to modern code. And the city, quote, just had to adjust a water tank that's currently under construction to meet the current highest standard. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
A On Tuesday, April 7th, the Eureka City Council discussed a wide range of issues. A main issue discussed during the meeting was the challenge of creating sanctioned encampments to alleviate the issue of unhoused people in downtown Eureka, whose homeless population has swelled in recent years. You'll hear from Mayor Kim Burgle, along with comments from the council. The discussion began with Councilmember Renee Contreras-Deloach giving a presentation on sanctioned encampment sites she visited in other areas, including in Portland, Oregon.
So we had staff that went up to Portland. They were accompanied by a representative for a potential private investor that's interested potentially in working with the city. And they were able to tour Multnomah Safe Village, Dignity Village, and then they also took a look at Weidler Village, which is a city alternative shelter. And then there were three site tours of structure manufacturers, LIT in Portland, Oregon, BLBS on the Hoopa Valley Reservation, and Humboldt Havens on the Hoopa Valley Reservation as well. So I have two things in here, and there will be a little bit of a contrast. One is you're going to see this very, very meticulously maintained one, and then you'll see Dignity Village, which is more they democratically run. It's like their own kind of HOA. They have their own. So this is run by Urban Alchemy, and so they have outreach workers that work there, and it's very tight. They have a lot of security. People can't come in there without, you know, permission, so the grounds are kept very, very clean, as you can see. So, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages both that I'm going to show you. So, you know, advantages to this, it's very clean. And, you know, there's bicycles, they run a tight ship, so to speak, and there's places for gardening and no significant issues for the community. Dignity Village was something that, this is Northeast Portland. This started as kind of like a housing protest in 2000, and then it turned into a, you know, more of a permanent thing. It was supposed to be temporary till they found another site. And of course, another site was not ever located by the city of Portland during that 3 years. And so they ended up officially sanctioning it. So it's considered democratically self-administered, self-governed, and self-operated. And so you see, again, advantages and disadvantages. The one that we were looking at before is very clean, but it almost looks like it could just be a storage facility for just, you know, people's belongings. When you look at this one, you'll see that there's some challenges with this, but you'll also see, you know, art and plants, and, you know, it definitely has kind of more of a lived-in kind of thing going on. Something else to note with Dignity Village is it's really out in the middle of nowhere. It's not close to services, so there's a lesson to be had there as well. So they have articles of incorporation. They have, like, a board, and they kind of, you know, they have their way of kind of governing it. But you can see building supplies and building materials. This is the type of stuff that, you know, in here, you know, our zoning and stuff like that, this would end up being an abatement issue. It's not safe. And they did say to staff that they have a lot of fires, that this community has had quite a few fire calls. I think there's probably a happy medium between the two. I think the takeaway from something like this is that, you know, anything, you know, the city has already moved forward, you know, with Bayside Village and some of these other things. Anything that we do as a city that we have our hands on, probably then, you know, for liability reasons, we need to be really careful about.
I don't need to know specific names, but just like number of potential partners talked with, mm-hmm. Number of sites that would potentially be available.
Spoken to, we've recently applied for a private donation from an entity south of here and have heard back from them, and we're working with them. There's the individual that Councilmember Contreras-Deloach spoke of, and the location. So there's been two that have been talking about as far as partnering, as far as funding opportunities. We did meet once with AHA and had discussions similar to the discussions that we had previously. It was only one meeting, nothing after that. But other than the structure that we had discussed with you, Councilmember Castellano, with AHA at that time, there wasn't much further about the actual organization of how it would be operated or anything. As far as locations, we obviously Betty owns property on 2nd and A Street, and that's been an area that we've been concentrating on funding for. We've looked into the permanent local PLHA for funding for that, to have that site prepped for a site. We're on our second rendition of funding for that. the two individuals that we've spoken to, well, the donation as well as the individual, were also concentrated on that site as well. We have a layout designed for that site, and that layout has been proposed to both the private donors. We got really good news today. Our staff had spoken to that organization, and based on those conversations, we're optimistic, but we won't know until we hear back from them.
And how many units would that be potentially?
40 units right now. Okay. And what we're looking at, we have that grant out for $600,000 for the prep of the site. The donation we're looking at is 2.4, and that would include the prep of the site as well as the units.
Great. And any other sites?
We were offered a private site. That offer, we believe, still stands, but it would likely take somebody other than the city of Eureka to be the person that we're operating. It does meet the zoning requirements, and if they're...
Mayor Kim Burgle responded with some skepticism.
I do appreciate that you did a lot of work on this, but it feels like we're still in the same place. We still don't have a location. We potentially have one or two now, but those have been being worked on for a while. We still don't know who's going to live there, who's willing to live there? We don't have an idea about how these things are going to be funded and who's going to run it. So I guess those were my questions about when you were doing the ad hoc committee. Those were the kinds of things that I was looking forward to hearing. I love that you partnered with Hoopa, that you met with the Hoopa tribe, and I think that can be a really great partnership for us. But without a location, it's not going to be very helpful. I can understand how some people are afraid, and we've got to come up with some ideas. And we've been working on it, and we've been working on it, and we've been working on it.
In the end, the council accepted the report on sanctioned homeless encampments, but took no immediate steps to implement its findings locally.
The last remaining unbeaten team in HDNL baseball moved two wins clear of the chasing pack in the Little Four with a doubleheader sweep on Tuesday. Hello and welcome to this week's Kaymood News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the Little Four leaders in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including all the latest HDNL baseball and softball news, some college baseball and softball updates, and where one local all-league player is taking her talents after graduation this year. But first up, it's been a good season so far for the St. Bernard's baseball team, and the Crusaders are showing no signs of slowing down. On Tuesday, the unbeaten Crusaders hosted the South Fork Cubs in a Little Four doubleheader with the early conference lead on the line. And it was the home team that walked away with a pair of shutout victories to go to 4-0 in the Little Four and move two wins clear of the chasing pack. The Crusaders won 7-0 and 1-0, and they succeeded with some standout pitching, with four pitchers combining to hold the Cubs to just four hits over the two games. Senior Tyler Heinrichs got the start on the mound in the opener and threw six strong innings, allowing one hit and four walks and striking out 11. Freshman Taylor Bailey pitched the final inning to secure the win. Junior Garrett Shanahan got the start in game two and threw five scoreless innings, allowing just two hits and two walks and striking out six, before sophomore Saewon Kwon took over and threw two scoreless innings for the save. With the two wins, the SB boys improved to 12-0 on the season, while the Cubs dropped to 2-2 in the Little Four and 6-9 overall. Also in the Little Four on Tuesday, the Ferndale boys got their first conference win after dropping two games to St. Bernard's last week. The Cats hosted Hoopa and withstood a late rally by the visitors to hold on for a 9-6 win, improving to 1-2 in the Little Four and 9-2 overall. The Hoopa boys dropped to 0-3 and 4-6. The battle for the Little Four softball championship, meanwhile, is shaping up to be an exciting race with little to separate the main contenders. After splitting a conference opening doubleheader last week, the South Fork and Hoopa girls both swept league doubleheaders on Tuesday to move into a tie atop the standings. The Cubs traveled to play St. Bernard's at the Bear River Sports Complex and escaped with two wins. They appeared to be cruising to victory in the opener and led 11-1 going into the bottom of the fifth inning. But the Crusaders had other ideas and came storming back to take a 15-12 advantage going into the seventh. The Cubs, however, are defending conference champs for a reason, and they would answer, adding four more runs in the seventh inning on the way to a 16-15 win. Game 2 wasn't as close, with the Cubs winning 10-0 to go to 3-1 in the Little Four and joining Hoopa atop the conference standings. The Hoopa girls traveled to play Ferndale and won both of their games, 12-0 and 9-7, also improving to 3-1 in the Little Four. All four Little Four softball teams will be back in action with two more doubleheaders next Tuesday. Hoopa travels to play two games against St. Bernard's, while South Fork will host Ferndale. In Big 5 softball, it's been a good start to conference play for the Eureka Loggers. After going winless last year, Eureka could be the most improved team in the HDNL this spring. They opened conference play on Saturday and split a doubleheader with Fortuna, handing the Huskies their first loss of the year. Fortuna held on late for a 3-2 victory in Game 1, but the Loggers would bounce back immediately, taking Game 2 12-7. Eureka followed that with an 8-2 win over Arcata on Wednesday to go to 2-1 in the Big 5 and 5-7 overall. Fortuna, meanwhile, lost 3-2 at McKinleyville on Wednesday as the Panthers improved to 1-0 in conference play and the Huskies dropped to 1-2. Three-time defending Big 5 champs Del Norte began their conference schedule with a doubleheader sweep over Arcata on Saturday, winning both games by the narrowest of margins. The Warriors took Game 1 7-6 and followed that with a 2-1 victory in Game 2. In Big 5 baseball, it's been a good start to conference play for the Eureka boys, who won all three of their games this week. The Loggers hosted Fortuna on Saturday and won both games with some outstanding pitching. Senior Ty Crawford pitched a no-hitter in Game 1, which Eureka won 11-0, and sophomore Braden Bermers pitched a complete Game 2-hitter in Game 2, which Eureka won 8-0. The Loggers continued to roll on Wednesday with a 5-1 win over Arcata, with sophomore Kyle Giacconi throwing a complete Game 1-hitter. Del Norte also enjoyed a good opening day in conference play, sweeping a doubleheader against Arcata in Crescent City on Saturday, winning 4-0 and 10-0. The McKinleyville Panthers began their conference schedule on Wednesday, beating Fortuna 15-0. Eureka is now 3-0 in the Big 5, while Del Norte is 2-0 and McKinleyville 1-0, with Fortuna and Arcata both 0-3. Big 5 action in baseball and softball is scheduled to continue on Saturday, providing the weather cooperates. Eureka will travel to McKinleyville for doubleheaders in both sports, while both Fortuna teams will travel to Crescent City to take on Del Norte. In college baseball, College of the Redwoods continued to struggle against runaway conference leaders Feather River last weekend, dropping two games by scores of 9-0 and 16-6. Sior is now 2-17 in the Golden Valley Conference and 4-28 overall. The Sior women also are struggling in conference play. The Corsairs hosted Feather River in a doubleheader last weekend and lost both games, 17-1 and 2-1. Redwoods is now 2-8 in conference and 9-16-1 overall. The Cal Poly Humboldt softball team fared better over the weekend, winning three of their four games against Cal State Monterey Bay and improving to 9-7 in conference and 18-19 overall. The Jacks are scheduled to host Cal State San Bernardino in a four-game series this weekend and are now third in the conference standings. And rounding out another busy week in local sports, Eureka High senior Macy Secor announced recently that she will play volleyball at College of the Redwoods after graduation later this year. Secor, who is also a standout softball player, signed her letter of intent to play for Redwoods at a letter signing ceremony at Sior. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Marr, and thanks to our reporters Daniel Mintz, Ray Hamill, and Gabriel Zucker. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media, including Facebook and Instagram. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. I'd also like to remind folks before the end of our broadcast that our spring membership drive is April 13th to the 22nd. Please click the donate button on kmud.org. Your donations help keep our local news on the air. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.